from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. We'll begin this morning's broadcast with a discussion of the recent protests in Egypt and Libya over two anti-Muslim videos, which led in Benghazi to the death of four Americans, including U.S.-Libyan Ambassador Chris Stevens, a Bay Area native from Piedmont who graduated from UC Berkeley and Hastings Law School. Here's President Obama speaking about the tragedy earlier this morning.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms this outrageous and shocking attack. And make no mistake, we will work with the Libyan government to bring to justice the killers who attacked our people.
Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Hours after demonstrators scaled the wall of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo in protest over two anti-Muslim videos, U.S. Ambassador to Libya Chris Stevens, a Bay Area native, and three other Americans were killed as a crowd set fire to the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. In this opening Forum hour, we want to talk about the recent events and, well, the ongoing volatility in the Middle East. And joining us, first of all, from Cairo, is Tariq El-Tabawi, who is Cairo Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. And we welcome you to the program. Good morning. It's good morning here, of course.
Right. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your being with us. And the initial question, I think, on many minds is, this was set off, as I said, by a couple of anti-Muslim videos. But one wonders, is it like what happened in Afghanistan with the burning of the – in fact, one of these videos was made by the preacher from Florida who burned a Quran. Was it that sort of incident, or do we have something deeper here that really reflects anti-Americanism?
I'm not sure I'd really take it to that, you know, down that track. I mean, the issue here is fairly simple. I mean, Muslims, by and large, worldwide, view any kind of depiction of the Prophet as sacrilegious or blasphemous. I mean, you're not supposed to show pictures of him, or you're not supposed to draw pictures or depict him in film. So the fact that, number one, you've got him depicted in film, and number two, in a very kind of unflattering way, to put it diplomatically, I think is one of the things that really has triggered the outrage, you know. And then build on to that, that this is not by any means the first instance. I mean, you've got the Danish Prophet cartoons back in 2005, the incident in Afghanistan, as you mentioned. You know, you can even go back as far as the Satanic Verses and Salman Rushdie. I mean, this is an ongoing grievance that people have had, you know, in the region, both in the Arab world and elsewhere in the Islamic world.
Is this more Salafists, though? I understand that a lot of this, at least in Cairo, biggest demonstration since the Mubarak regime was brought down, about 2,000 people, I'm reading, that the Salafists had a great deal to do with it?
Well, we certainly had bigger demonstrations than that. I mean, there's, you know, by and large, there were, you know, we were seeing a lot of Islamists, and by Islamists, you know, including moderates, more moderates, as well as the Salafists. You know, I think what's noteworthy here in Egypt is that this really was essentially a capped demonstration. I mean, it could have, you know, gone tragically out of hand as it did in Libya. And, you know, thank God it obviously didn't. I mean, it stopped with the graffiti, with people climbing the walls, pulling down the flag, and, you know, and that's kind of where they drew the line at that point. But it certainly could have gotten a lot worse, you know, very easily.
And wasn't there anger in the demonstration also against the Coptic Egyptians, Coptic Christians?
Yeah, I mean, there's talk or reports here that there was involvement by U.S.-based Copts. And there's actually been a couple cases or complaints that have been filed with the General Prosecutor's Office here in Cairo, naming a couple of individuals, you know, look over the role or their alleged role in this film. And I think, you know, what's interesting in this is that it brings to light these kind of ongoing and somewhat simmering sectarian tensions that have been taking place in the country for certainly since the uprising last year, but have a much more deep-rooted history in Egypt.
Where do you see those headed? I mean, down the line here, especially in the short term.
Well, I think everyone's been very quick and very careful to distance themselves from, you know, from what's going on. I mean, we had the prime minister today coming out and saying that Egyptians were speaking in one voice, Muslim and Christians alike, and condemning the video or the film and the depiction of the prophet, which they said, you know, really kind of transgressed the limits of free speech and just was essentially a provocative act. Really, you know, we had the Muslim Brotherhood earlier issuing a statement saying that this, you know, this film was really intended to sow sectarian tensions in the country, and that it will fail, as have other efforts to do so failed in the past few months.
The film actually depicted Muhammad, I believe, as a pedophile, and had him talking to his donkey and all kinds of just outrageous and maybe even by most standards crazy types of things. I guess what's disturbing, though, is that it happened on 9/11 and the American flag was torn down.
I mean,
the initial question I asked you, in fact, was, you know, how much of this had to do perhaps with anti-Americanism, but there seemed to be a lot of blame. The American flag burned and brought down, and the American embassy attacked.
I mean, well, there's no denying, I mean, whether this was a calculated coincidence or just a coincidence on in of itself that, you know, this happened on that particular day. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone can make a case that there isn't a measure of anti-American sentiment throughout the Arab world. I mean, we certainly... You know, and that goes back not just to incidents like these, but you've got the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has kind of resonated very deeply in the Muslim and Arab psyche, with the perceived bias towards Israel. I mean, so none of this really kind of has developed in a vacuum. I mean, it's just all it takes is one little thing to kind of set, to light the fuse and set the whole thing, in motion, if I can use a mixed metaphor, I guess.
Tariq El-Tablawi with us from Cairo. He's Cairo Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. And I appreciate very much you being with us.
No problem. Appreciate it.
I thank you. And let me bring Aaron David Miller into this discussion, the distinguished scholar with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who has advised both Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State. And Aaron, good morning to you.
Morning, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. Also, we have Janine Zakaria, whom I believe you know, who's here with us in studio.
I do. Hello, Janine.
Hello, Aaron.
And Janine is a visiting lecturer now at Stanford. She's also a former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post, and will be appearing at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco at noon on Friday.
Outstanding journalist, Michael, by the way.
Yeah, well, she speaks well of you, too. And she also informed me that you knew Ambassador Chris Stevens?
I did. We worked together briefly when he was at the consulate in Jerusalem, and I think above all, above anything that's been said this morning, a terrific man and an outstanding diplomat and a profound loss.
And what do you make of his loss and the loss of three other Americans? Again, it certainly was triggered by a lot of this what's perceived as anti-Muslim sentiment and the Prophet Muhammad being displayed in a way that is unacceptable, but it seems to go deeper than that, doesn't it?
You know, I think it really does. I've been thinking about this, Michael, and I really see this as a kind of perfect storm, which is driven by at least three factors. Number one, I do believe, even before the Arab Spring, there was a rising current of anti-American sentiment in this region. Our policies are profoundly disliked, and when the authoritarians, the adversarial and acquiescent authoritarians who kept the lid on, were forced from power, public opinion and public sentiment has played a much greater role now in shaping the political climate. It is no coincidence. It would strain the bounds of credulity to the breaking point to assume that this was some haphazard random event which had nothing to do with the anniversary of 9/11. That's number one. Number two, I think that with the emergence of the rise of Islam and militant Islam and Salafis and others, I do believe that groups and individuals are exploiting this current climate to essentially harness the power of these disgusting portrayals, whether it's in film or in other media, of a profound disrespect to Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. There's no question that these are orchestrated events. But there's also another issue which to me is very troubling and extremely controversial, and that is the conflation that exists in the minds of too many Islamists that the West is somehow responsible. The West, the United States, America, Denmark, for the efforts of individuals who, in a climate of freedom of conscience and freedom of expression, essentially at least in this society, in this system, have the right to express their views. And I think it's not the grievances that are so alarming. I'm not a religious man, but I would be aggrieved too if some of the images that you yourself conveyed, that this filmmaker conveyed in his film, assaulted and insulted my religion. It is crossing the line from grievance to violence.
It's also not recognizing, as you suggest, that this is an individual who may be a loon, but from their point of view is an American and therefore is somehow culpable,
right.
Making
and
America
I would,
culpable, I mean.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I would remind you that in 1981, a Turkish Muslim, tried to kill the Pope. I mean, the representative, God's representative of over a billion Christians on earth. And I'd ask you, we'd have to check, but we'd have to try to determine how many Muslim embassies were trashed, how many Muslims were killed in response to that. And yet the publication of these terrible cartoons led to the deaths, I think, of almost 100 people. So there is this dysfunction. It's politically incorrect to talk about it, but it is a reality. And finally, one additional point. I think these new regimes have not yet demonstrated a capacity to maintain the kind of security, whether it's inability or it's an unwillingness. The governments of Libya and Egypt need to be told in no uncertain terms by our government that a condition for cooperation, forget economic reform, forget the relationship with Israel for now, but they need to be told in unmistakable terms as a condition of continued cooperation and assistance from the United States of America that they are responsible for the safety and security of American citizens and American diplomats.
One assumes that Mohamed Morsi has received that message. And yet there's a great deal of concern, not only that you're raising here about Egypt, but maybe even to a greater extent about Libya. Now, Libya has apologized profusely, and in fact, Secretary Clinton said that they took Ambassador Stevens to the hospital and they were trying to protect him from more violence being done to him, but by this point he was dying. I'm just wondering what your read is on the changes in Libya, given the fact that they still have those weapons. We don't even know how they're accounted for. There's a strong influence, maybe a stronger influence from Al-Qaeda in Libya.
Well, yeah, I mean, let me say, I'm not blaming the government of Libya. This is a message cast to the future about what their responsibilities are. But look, I don't know the circumstances of Chris Stevens' death. What I do know that is if his convoy was targeted willfully, then this was not some sort of haphazard. He's a well-known figure. They know who he is. They know what a diplomatic convoy is all about. So the question is whether or not this was not orchestrated and, in fact, controlled by some jihadi group. We don't know the answer to that. But I already pick up traces of the Pentagon, faint echo traces of trying to identify jihadi camps in Libya. Would it surprise me in the next several days or weeks if you saw American military action against some of these identifiable groups in Libya? It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Boy, after all that effort not to have boots on the ground in Libya, huh? I mean, what an irony that would be.
Well, you can do a lot as NATO proved from the air without putting boots on the ground.
Let me be. I know you have to go, and before you go, I'm just wondering a lot of this disruptiveness going on now because of. We had, in fact, the Bloomberg News Cairo bureau chief mention Israel and Palestinian. You've been involved for years in all of that. There's been a lot of saber rattling, and now Prime Minister Netanyahu supposedly rebuffed. Is that going to blow up, and are we going to see actually a preemptive strike against Iran? Is that inevitable?
You know, I've been staking what's left of my professional reputation on two facts. Barring a provocation by the Iranians, there will be no unilateral Israeli attack on Iran between now and our elections. And in my judgment, between now and the end of the year, and the same for the United States. This is a 2013 issue. But if it's not joined seriously in 2013, I suspect somebody is going to launch a military strike or strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities.
Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and advisor to both Republican and Democratic Secretaries of State. Aaron, always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Michael, it's always a pleasure to be here. And Janine, it's terrific to talk to you, however indirectly.
Great to hear your voice, Aaron.
And Janine, let's get you on record about these recent events in Egypt and Libya. How do you read them?
Well, I just want to pick up on a couple of things that Aaron put out there. I think the distinction that I saw in what happened between Libya and Egypt from the security point of view is, at least from what I'm hearing and from talking to people in Washington, is at least some Libyan security forces, such as they are post-revolution, did try their best to combat the riot that was emerging around the consulate where the ambassador was visiting, and they did try to help. Whereas in the Egyptian context, my understanding was that the security forces stood by as they mounted this riot alongside the walls of the embassy. And I've spent a lot of time in Cairo and been near that embassy. I've also watched the Egyptian riot police and what they're capable of when they want to disperse a crowd. So I think that there's a fundamental difference in the way the two countries approach this. Also, you had President Obama today saying that we are now going to ramp up the security at our installations around the world. And I think that could be something that we need to look at, because it seems always that on 9/11 that you should have a greater presence, especially in a country like Libya, where, in fact, it is known that in eastern Libya this is a breeding ground for radical Islamists. If you go back to the Iraq War, this is where a lot
of
fighters
went.
They all went from eastern Libya. Yeah. Benghazi's right there. So I'm curious why the State Department had not ramped up some forces ahead of time. Perhaps they did, and we're just not aware of it yet. And also, in terms of just lastly on what Aaron was saying about the fundamental misunderstanding of the way the United States works on things like freedom of speech and whatever, President Morsi's spokesman came out and said that President Obama should prosecute the makers of this despicable film. Like, there's not really a conception of how it works, you know, and I think that's something that's going to be a problem going forward in the U.S.-Egypt relations as well.
Well, it's also what's moving forward is how much impact this is having on the presidential election. I mean, I had alluded before to what has been described as the snubbing of Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, and this is certainly the Romney forces talking about his support for Israel, as opposed to, I think, Governor Romney's words were that President Obama threw Israel under the bus. But also, Egypt and Libya are kind of expanding into this realm, too. I mean, the idea that somehow when President Obama went to Cairo and gave his speech and then later on didn't support our ally, I mean, probably Mubarak would have fallen anyway, but the right has been saying he didn't support our ally. And now we have a Muslim Brotherhood leader, and now we have chaos and anti-Americanism, and the argument goes to Libya as well. And how legitimate is that argument? I mean, from your perspective, or does it have any legitimacy? Is it viable?
Well, I don't think that anybody on the right is actually saying we should have supported our ally, Muammar Gaddafi. So I think it's two different. In that respect, it's two different situations.
Forgive me, but after the four deaths today, I was here happened to be reading, as I do generally, from the left and the right. And so and there are people
maybe
saying
there are,
Gaddafi
perhaps.
Compared to American ambassador getting killed. American ambassador never got killed under Gaddafi.
Look, I think, you know what? The truth is the United States wanted Mubarak to remain in power. It was only I was in Cairo at the time as this changed, as the U.S. position, if you remember, back in January, February 2011, it morphed. And as they saw that Mubarak was failing and unable to hold on to power is when they started to shove him aside. It was not by choice. This has been the policy for the United States for decades, that they would rather work with the dictators precisely for this reason. It was the same thing, I mean, to go a little farther afield with President Musharraf in Pakistan. And you have enormous instability there now as a result of the fact that, you know, he's gone and it's different people vying for power. You see it in Afghanistan. We now see it in the Near East as well, Egypt and Libya, of course.
So the anger against America just builds and becomes cumulative and then explodes.
Yeah, and it was interesting. When I was reporting there last year, though, my sense was more than anti-Americanism, America was just not relevant to the conversation. It was, you know, everybody was very focused on their own issues at the time. But now you see obviously an uptick in the anti-Americanism for sure.
Well, this is something I think that's important that we're discussing. And obviously in the wake of this tragedy, some of you have some strong emotions and some thoughts that you'd like to render. So I'm going to give out the phone number and tell you how you can communicate to us your thoughts or your reactions to what, well, the killing of U.S. ambassador in Libya and three other Americans by armed protesters in a protest over an anti-Muslim video. And this is, of course, not the first time that there's been violence with respect to videos. We mentioned, in fact, before the cartoons and other sorts of things that have set off this kind of a reaction or been a trigger to it. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we'd like to hear from you, and please feel free to join us. You can do that now at 866-733-6786. We welcome your contributions to the conversation, so feel free to join us by phone, 866-733-6786. You can also join us by email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you have on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page, or communicate with us by Twitter, and our handle at Twitter is @kqedforum. Talking really about recent events, tragic events in Libya, and also about, well, you can't get away from, I think, Janine, the sense that this is put into a perspective of America somehow not being as responsive or as sensitive to the Prophet and to treating Islam with respect.
Yeah, I think this is something that, you know, not only America, but the West in general, Europe, United States, everyone has got to sort of think about, and how are we going to do this? It's part of the larger conversation I think President Obama tried to start to have when he took office in addressing the Muslim world. And then it kind of dropped off a little bit. I think it's something that's going to come back more into focus right now. But as you were saying earlier, Michael, I mean, in a striking way this week, foreign policy has displaced some of the other issues of this campaign. And I don't know if this is going to be a 2-day story, a 3-day story, but between this horrific attack in Libya, the loss of the first U.S. ambassador in the field in over 2 decades, a well-loved and admired figure, the prospect of more violence in North Africa and elsewhere, and obviously the flare-up that I'm sure we'll discuss on the Israel-U.S. front, the fact that Governor Romney is seizing on all of these things, I think it's going to be something we'll be discussing maybe right up to the election itself.
I think it's playing into the election much more than anybody would have anticipated.
Absolutely.
I mean, in terms of foreign policy. Well, let's bring some of our listeners into this discussion. We'll begin with a caller from New Jersey, Everett. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I just want to say briefly, I think this is an issue of free speech, pure and simple. And I think Americans all over should stand up for the principle that we should stand up for our culture. I hear too many apologies. I mean, the fact that the president had to say, oh, this was a terrible film, and we, you know, we believe in freedom of religion in this country, that's all well and good, but the defining issue for me is the free speech. And we shouldn't kowtow and let ourselves be humble and feel, put ourselves in a defensive position because some people all over the world don't appreciate what we do within the borders of our country. That's all.
All right. I thank you for that statement, Everett. And that's part of what's made this political. Initially, some of the diplomatic statements that came out before Secretary Clinton spoke directly were to the effect that it was almost as if there was a kind of an apology. And this is just what has played its way into the presidential campaign. Apologies should not be what America's all about. You know, America doesn't have to apologize and our freedom and so forth. I mean, that's what we're seeing take place here and unfold in this drama. Let me bring another caller on, though, and we'll go next to Georgia. And we welcome Jim. You're on, Jim. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I just had a thought. We got to stop coddling these radical Muslims with their religious thing. I can understand honoring a religion and respecting it. But they go ahead and killing people over it, and we just stand back and don't. It's an act of war, I think.
All right, I thank you. First couple of calls are right out of the chute. They happen to be outside of the area, but you get the sentiment. We'll return. We'll talk more with you and hear from you and talk more with our guest, Janine Zakaria, and others. I'm Michael Krasny.
Let me be clear. There is no justification for this. None. Violence like this is no way to honor religion or faith. And as long as there are those who would take innocent life in the name of God, the world will never know a true and lasting peace.
That, of course, is Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking in the wake of the tragedy that occurred in Libya and Benghazi that included the killing of 4 Americans. including Ambassador Chris Stevens. We thought we'd bring Phyllis Bennis into this discussion, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. Her books include Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a primer, and The Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. And Phyllis Bennis, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Great to be with you, Michael.
First of all, you just heard Secretary Clinton, and she's certainly giving the proper deference to not putting up with violence and not tolerating it. But how do you read what happened, particularly in Libya, as well as in Cairo?
Well, I think there's two separate things going on, and we really don't have enough information yet to know how much they're connected. One is that there was massive public outrage about this film. The film's apparently been out for a while, but it only recently was had parts of it translated into Arabic and became available in the Middle East. And there was not surprisingly, there was outrage. It looks like the guy who made the film may well have had that in mind. I mean, he was not concerned about the impact of the film. But the question
in
of
fact,
whether,
excuse me, he, from his statements, he may have wanted this to occur to show the lack of tolerance in the Islamic
certainly
world.
Certainly possible, yeah. Exactly. But whether that was actually what gave rise to this more massive attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi is not yet clear. There are conflicting reports on what actually happened to the ambassador. There's one report that, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, that indicated that some sources on the ground said that he may have been killed when an RPG hit his car as he was trying to get himself and others out. They were trying to evacuate, and his car was hit. If that's the case, it implies that this attack on the consulate may not have been simply an escalation of a popular demonstration, that it may have been a different group of people. And certainly what it points to is the reality of post-Gaddafi Libya, where the militarization of that struggle against Libya, and particularly the involvement of outside military forces, the U.S. and NATO, left behind not a stable, calm, peaceful, democratic Libya, as I think, I'm afraid, some would like us to believe, but in fact a country which is massively unstable, where there are numerous militias continuing to keep their arms, use their arms, move about the country, refusing to bring themselves under the authority of the newly elected national government or its predecessor. There is a growing number of Salafis, the very extremist form of Islam, in some of these militias. This is a branch of the kind of Muslim government that the Saudis have put in place, but in the most extreme forms of it, very violent. And it may well be, there were also reports that one or more of the Salafi-linked militias in Libya today claimed some involvement in the attack. One said, well, we didn't carry out the attack, but some of our people did. It's very vague. We simply don't have, at least that I've seen, reliable enough information yet to know. But what we do know is that it took, apparently, the killing of the U.S. ambassador and potentially U.S. and other U.S. Officials to shine a spotlight on the really chaotic and disastrous situation facing Libya today. This is not, you know, we're looking at the consequence of this, the chaos that overcame the country in the context of the overthrow and killing of Gaddafi. And we're seeing part of that, meaning the Salafi forces appear to be on the rise. This, of course, links it more regionally to the question of what might be the case in Syria as well. There's some very sobering questions here, even beyond the tragic killing of a very popular ambassador.
And as long as we're talking about the region in general and you bring in Syria, what do you suspect is going to happen vis-a-vis Israel and Iran at this point with all the talk about preemptive strikes and trying to bring America on board? And now it would appear that recent reports, President Obama isn't even willing necessarily to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Well, this has been about a 6 to 8 week process inside Israel, where the Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, has been escalating quite dramatically the pressure on the Obama administration. It's clearly tied to the U.S. election cycle. There's no question about it. And his position has focused on trying to ratchet up a campaign that says Obama's not supporting us enough. he's not backing our red lines. The most recent escalation that you're referring to, Michael, I think was in response to Hillary Clinton's statement over the weekend where she said, we are not setting deadlines in Iran. Now, in fact, that's not quite accurate. The U.S.
Well, she was also quoted as saying there's time for diplomacy to work, which
right.
is...
Right. It's not quite true that the U.S. has not set red lines. It has. It's set a red line of Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon. But that is a far cry from the Israeli red line, which is what they call Iran achieving nuclear capability, something that is not officially defined in international law, but is widely thought to include basically access to enriched uranium, which, of course, Iran has because of its legal and inspected nuclear power program, and the scientific capacity, the scientific know-how to go further. Now, Iran has that as well, as we've seen in the assassination of at least five Iranian nuclear scientists in the recent period. So in that context, there's a wide gap between the U.S. red line and the Israeli red line. And the Netanyahu challenge to President Obama is basically, you're not accepting our red line, and therefore we're going to keep the pressure on. We're going to claim that you are not supporting Israel. And at a moment when the U.S. election cycle is at its height, that presents a huge challenge for President Obama. And the threat, of course, that if Israel goes against the urging of not only the U.S., but every one of its allies and its opponents across the world and its own military and intelligence experts, its top officials have said a strike on Iran would be a disaster. It's really only the prime minister right now, even his defense minister, who was supporting the call for a strike, has pulled back a little bit.
It appears that Ehud Barak is pulling back more than a little bit.
More than a little bit, indeed.
Yeah.
So it's leaving Netanyahu, the prime minister, quite isolated, but it also means that he is spending a huge amount of his own political capital with this claim that Iran is an existential threat, that only a military threat, a military strike, can really save us. And the danger is he's going to box himself in politically and carry out such a strike, no matter how disastrous it may be. That leads directly to the question of what would be the consequences for Iran and Iranians, for Israel and Israelis, for the rest of the region, and crucially for the U.S. election. This is something, you know, that they've made very clear. Netanyahu wants Romney to win. There's no question about that.
They're old pals, actually. I mean, they have a connection that goes back to the corporate world many, many years ago. But I think you're right in seeing all of this tied together, and it therefore becomes even more urgent to really understand it. And I appreciate your shedding light, as you always do with us. Phyllis Bennis, again, is a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies. And we wanted to move along and hear from some of our listeners, as well as, and we'll be talking in the course of the time we have left, to Thomas Hendrickson, who is a senior fellow at Hoover. As I mentioned earlier, we'll continue this discussion on a number of levels. Let me go to Jack, who's joining us from Sunnyvale next. Jack, you're on.
Yes, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate this program and all of the great work that you've done. And I want to say I strongly disagree with the two previous callers who were saying that we should stop coddling people in the Middle East, Muslims who react with violent rage when somebody denigrates their religion. This is a height of arrogance, and the fact is that we have free speech in this country, but we really ought to think about the fact that we don't let people yell fire in a theater, because people can die. And I think that what the filmmaker is, behavior is reprehensible.
Well, I thank you for those comments. I'm looking at some comments coming in by email, though, and they seem to counter that point of view. Here's Rick from Palo Alto, who writes, I can't believe that we're all required to tiptoe around. Heaven forbid that we offend any Muslim, even the most evil and insane. When do we stop? Do we have to become Muslims, each and every one of us? I say no, this is insane. Muslims in the Middle East are offended by many of our behaviors. Our women do not dress properly. Our TV is profane in the extreme. Let the Muslims get back to reality. Western societies have rights that should not be reduced to make other countries happy, especially countries that murder their own children for marrying someone not approved of by their families. David writes, when Muslims are accused of being intolerant and barbaric, why do they respond in a way that only validates this? Why don't they get that violence is never a response that benefits their cause. Another listener writes, pardon the naive question, but why do these particular Muslims seem so thin-skinned? They appear to let crackpots in the U.S. pull and yank their chains at will. And Keith says, would it be legal or desirable to bar such films from being shown in theaters or have them blocked from YouTube as hate speech? They incite anger and riots. What about the law here? Well, let me bring in another caller on this. And this is someone actually who knew the ambassador. Dylan from Oakland, join us. Hi.
Thank you for taking my call, Michael. Not to overstate it, Chris Stevens was a very close friend of mine in law school, and that was more than 20 years ago. We kept in touch thereafter for a few years, but then we lost touch. But I just wanted to offer, sort of go from the political to the personal and say, this was a guy who was just an enormously decent human being who left the world of corporate law to do what he considered to be good in the world and you know, was more values-driven than almost anyone I've ever met. And I just think that it's an enormous loss for our community and for the nation. This was just an enormously decent human being.
Well, I thank you for saying those words in memoriam. He was, from all accounts, not only from Secretary Clinton, but from many who knew him here in the Bay Area, quite an exceptional and amazing man indeed. And, well, we mourn him. Let me go back to Janine Zakaria, who's here with us in studio, a visiting lecturer from Stanford, who is also former Jerusalem bureau chief and Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. In this whole region with Syria and with things going on that we've seen recently in Libya and Egypt with the threat of war between Israel and Iran, just seems like such a powder keg. I mean, it seems like it could really go off at any time.
Well, it's the Middle East, you know. I mean, it's obviously there's always fraught times as things ebb and flow, and certainly we're in this period of the unknown as the Arab Spring unfolded, and now we have new leadership that is kind of taking a hold. You've got all the threats that Phyllis Bennis was mentioning with Salafis and radical Islamists and all of that. But, I mean, if we could just single out, we really haven't talked about Syria, and it wasn't on our agenda today per se, but 20,000 people have died in the Syrian conflict in the past year, I believe, is the number. It may even be a little bit higher right now.
I think it is higher. Yeah.
And
it's
not an issue that is entering the campaign like some of them. Obviously, we're talking about Libya and Egypt today because of the tragic death of Chris Stevens. But, you know, the Syria issue was one also that has the potential to really, really spread over into other borders. And it's just as a humanitarian issue. And yet it's really not affecting the discourse here in the United States. And when it comes to the Israel-Iran issue, I mean, this is an issue that comes up pretty routinely every 2-3 months. There's a sense that maybe Israel's going to strike. I am of the opinion, like Aaron Miller, that it's not going to happen before the election. The Israelis, it's not going to happen perhaps by the end of the year. I don't believe, because the Israelis, I mean, Bibi is at foremost, anybody who knows him, he is a politician. And only,
he's got more than half of the Israelis who don't back the idea of a preemptive strike.
I think the last figure I saw, I might be off by a percent or two, was I think 19% of Israelis, which only 19% would support a unilateral Israeli strike without U.S. agreement. So, I mean, he has his situation. He's got his own. It's been well documented. Top officials saying the intelligence is concerning but not frightening, i.e. on Iran's nuclear program. He doesn't have the support of his own national security advisors. So he's not exactly free to do it, which is precisely why he is demanding the U.S. give red lines for why it would attack, because he knows he needs the U.S. to attack because he cannot do it alone. That's my view on this.
Not even clear what those red lines are from either side, but you got 2,100 centrifuges buried deep in maybe an impenetrable underground lab, and you have movement forward toward getting the bomb. I mean, it almost seems inevitable from Netanyahu's point of view that they will, that is, Iranians will eventually have a nuclear bomb. But whether they're willing to use it is another story. Also, we had a former ambassador to Germany and nuclear negotiator for Iran on just last week, and he was saying, impossible. You know, Khamenei, the Ayatollah Khamenei, thinks that use of nuclear weapons is sinful. But at the same time, you have all this rhetoric about destroying Israel and so forth.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's interesting because this is precisely why Bibi Netanyahu is getting anxious, because he's seeing a new consensus or idea at least emerging in the U.S. discourse that, okay, perhaps we just have to accept the inevitability of a nuclear Iran. You saw Bill Keller writing it in the New York Times this past weekend, concluding that I'd rather have a nuclear Iran than a preemptive war. So that certainly unsettled him. I mean, this is core to Bibi Netanyahu's politics and his being right now. He believes, you know, from talking and interviewing a lot of his advisors, from speaking to him, that this is his mission, that and this is what he's been successful at, rallying the world around the idea that we need to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. If that erodes, he has nothing else. There's no peace process with the Palestinians. There's no, I mean, he's got, Israel is incredibly isolated today. So this is the issue that he wants U.S. backing on, and he's now he's picked a war with Obama, you know, it's 8 weeks before the election on it.
I don't think the two of them ever really got along.
No, they did not.
Janine Zakaria here with us in studio, former Jerusalem Bureau Chief and Middle East Correspondent for The Washington Post. Let's bring Thomas Hendrickson into this discussion, Senior Fellow from the Hoover Institution at Stanford. His most recent book is American Power After the Berlin Wall. Tom Hendrickson, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I want to get your thoughts on what's unfolded for us and how you essentially envisage what's going on now in the Middle East with particularly the recent tragedy, the death of an American ambassador and three other Americans, and the rather large protests going on or that went on in Cairo.
Well, I mean, it's a very complicated situation, obviously, and the people in your studio and your callers and so forth have outlined. I do think that it's indicating the United States cannot stay out of the Middle East. I mean, I think the Obama administration is guilty in a sense of kind of committing a sort of blowback. We can't stay out of it. We would like to. No one wants another war, but there has to be means to intervene in some ways. We can't let Syria go as the way it has. We didn't let Bosnia. We didn't let Kosovo go down that way. We had to do something. And I think we have to intervene more dramatically than we have.
But as you heard from Janine Zakaria, excuse me, with respect to Syria, nobody seems to want to wade in those waters politically.
Dangerous. But at the same time, we can't wash our hands and expect not to be consequences of it. Whatever we do will probably somewhat be wrong. But I think staying totally out of it it'll feed into more extremism, Al Qaeda, and so forth. We have to sort of become more engaged. In the case of Libya, I think in some sense we're suffering the consequences of not doing more when the so-called Libya intervention was, and then the leading from behind and all of that, the spread of shoulder-fired missiles and so forth out of there, not doing anything. I think, in a way, we're not at war with Islam per se, but we are at war with certain elements within the Middle East and Al Qaeda, and we don't want Al Qaeda to salvage itself. If it might be pushed out of places like Afghanistan or held back and now spreading elsewhere. So I think there has to be a greater interest in doing things, and we can't simply say, oh, put everything on hold until after the election.
All right. I want to thank you for that, Tom. I want to get another caller in here, and that's Hisham. Good morning.
Hi. How's it going?
Hi.
Michael. I'm a Muslim, and I don't know of any Muslim in the U.S. who does not denounce what happened this morning. I woke up this morning and I read the news, and I was almost crying. And this has nothing to do with Islam. This is, ignorance. These people don't love the Prophet more than we do, and they don't do anything that, you know, that represents Islam at all. It's just pure ignorance. And I think the only way to solve this problem is we got to let, you know, the Muslims in the West and the scholars of the Muslims in the West, we got to spend a lot of money on them to educate the people in the East, because they're not practicing the real Islam. They have no clue what Islam is all about and the peaceful message of Islam. So I just, you know, it's just sad. And I also think that, you know, we need to be smart in the U.S., you know, people who make these kind of movies, we need to be smart about this. You know, we all respect freedom of speech. I'm a filmmaker myself, but we gotta be smart. You know, we're putting our men and women in danger when we do these things. So we have to think about it and be smart about it.
All right. I thank you for contributing those thoughts. I appreciate them very much, and appreciate very much all kinds of thoughts that are coming in here by email. Thank you, those of you who sent emails. Some will find some of these points of view strong and maybe even objectionable, but here they go, at least some of them. This is Robin who writes, your guest makes a salient point. Muslims hold a different standard of behavior for others. Their lack of tolerance is at the root of the problem. They come to America and expect that they can wear their religious clothing, but I cannot go to Saudi Arabia and wear the clothing I choose. They can attempt to take the life of a pope and rest assured that their embassies are safe. They can burn American flags and know their mosques are safe. Another listener, Joseph from San Francisco, says, I think your callers thus far are off the mark. I, of course, agree that this is a freedom of speech issue and that the man who made the video had the legal right to do it. However, in these arguments, we always seem to lose sight of the moral responsibilities that this right comes with. Just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should or that others should applaud you for asserting your right. Shakaria writes, leaders in the Muslim world have to come out and say raids, bombings, buildings, or killing people are not appropriate responses to show offense with a movie. At the same time, those governments have to give freedoms, like public discourse and the ability to write in dissent. The threads of a stable democracy are small gestures. And Stanley says, the producer, Sam Bakail, said he believes the movie will help his native land by exposing Islam's flaws to the world. How will this help Israel, or how will this help anything? Free speech, don't know. This appears to me as yelling fire in a crowded theater. There you have all of the outlines in many respects of just how complicated these issues are that we are dealing with there this morning. The New York Times is actually reporting breaking news that Obama officials say the attack in Libya may have been planned. We'll bring you more details as we get them. In the meantime, I want to remind you, you're listening to Forum. We're talking earlier with Aaron David Miller and with Tariq El-Tabwali. We now have Janine Zakaria with us, and we also spoke to Phyllis Bennis, and Tom Hendrickson is with us as well. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we will go to another of your calls. We'll go to Andy. Andy, you're on.
Hi, thank you, Michael. My condolences to the friends and family of the ambassador. I'm an entrepreneur and in the tech industry, and I often think, how could I go to my market, the people that would potentially buy my product, and basically kind of shove it down their throat and say, you know what, you need to buy this, you should, but don't tell them anything about the product. And when I think about the freedom of speech issues and the core values that we hold so dear here, I wonder if we go about any type of PR, if you will, or marketing, if you will, just education around the world in a way that Apple would. I mean, think about how much we love the Apple brand, so to speak, and how we've come to learn what that stands for. Well, what if we did that about the United States? Because we're asking people, I think some of the previous callers said this, we're asking people to believe in something that they don't understand. So let's help them understand before we kind of shove it down their throats. So I guess the question is, are we doing anything along those lines? Thank you.
Okay, we thank you. Janine?
Well, I mean, I covered the State Department for 5 years, and I traveled at length, circled the globe twice with Secretary Condoleezza Rice at the time, actually, and I visited many of our embassies, dozens of them. And you've got diplomats who are actually really trying to do this. They have information officers. One of the three other officials who was killed, along with Ambassador Chris Stevens, was the information officer, the person who was in charge of doing what that caller suggested, communicating with the public, explaining what America's about, explaining values like free speech. And they're trying to do this in a very trying environment. And in fact, the State Department has had programs where they have recruited people, I believe, from Silicon Valley and elsewhere to be their informal emissaries and envoys around the world to show the goodness of America and all these things. And unfortunately, when you're dealing with radical Islam and people who are committed to killing the U.S. ambassador, these messages don't always convey well.
You want to get a word in here, Tom Hendrickson? I mean, particularly in terms of America's responsibility to convey not only the message of freedom and what America stands for, but also to be, well, as some are arguing, we need to be much more sensitive and responsive to, the kind of thing that blew up here. That is what offends someone as being offensive to Islam.
Well, like most people, I'm offended by the fact that we offend religions. But on the other hand, if you look at what's coming out of the Middle East, some of the radical sheikhs, not just al-Qaeda members, say some pretty awful things about Israelis, about Americans, about our values. I mean, they have a sort of free speech for them. So obviously there's going to be sort of a counter-reaction in the United States by some people who aren't extreme, and they do things like the movie producer did. Or they have a minister down in Florida who wants to burn Korans. I don't like that. But on the other hand, they also do some pretty radical things and say some radical things about killing Americans. So I think that it's very difficult. I mean, and many of the messages you got in college hit the nail on the head. It is complicated, as you've indicated. But on the other hand, we can't also just sort of surrender and say, okay, we're not going to do these things, and the other side can do them. They can say these horrible things and make these threats, which do stir up people, not just al-Qaeda, but also people in the streets. So I do think that we can't sit back. Again, we just have to be more activists and proactive in this.
Very pointed question from a listener here, and maybe Janine Zakaria, you can shed some light on this. He wants to know, what were the U.S. security forces there, Marines, private contractors assigned to protect U.S. diplomatic corps figures and their vehicles, buildings, etc.? Do we know much?
I know that, you know, from my own experience in convoys, and he was, you know, on a visit to Benghazi, it's diplomatic security, which is its own kind of independent set of, you know, a lot of former military officials, servicemen, rather. But in this particular instance, I don't know, you know, usually outside the grounds of a U.S. embassy or consulate, it's the responsibility of the host nation to provide the security. So I don't know if there were any, it doesn't seem that there were adequate or even any, perhaps, U.S. servicemen positioned outside. I don't think they may have been inside as well.
The Cairo bureau chief from Bloomberg said earlier that they just kind of let it all happen and stood by. I mean, that was quite an indictment. Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly been an enlightening hour, a disturbing hour in the wake of this tragedy, but I'm glad we had an opportunity to shed light on it and talk about it and talk broadly about the Middle East. And I want to thank actually Tariq Al-Tabawi, whom I spoke of just a moment ago, the Cairo bureau chief from Bloomberg, who joined us at the top, and Aaron David Miller from Woodrow Wilson International Center of Scholars, who is also with us, and Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies. Thanks also to you, Janine Zakaria, who joined us here in studio, former and she'll be at the Commonwealth Club on Friday at noon, former Jerusalem bureau chief for the Washington Post. And thanks to Tom Hendrickson, who is senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Thanks to all of you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.